Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Alexandra Otolia-Baird, host of the channel, and today I'm talking to Nicholas B. Miller about his new book, John Miller and the Scottish Enlightenment, Family Life and World History, published by Voltaire Foundation's Oxford University Studies in the Enlightenment in 2017. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, hello. Nice to be here.
So to begin, we always like to ask authors to tell us a little bit about themselves and how you came to the topic of your book.
Right. So I guess I'd start by saying that I come from a multicultural background. My mother was born in the Philippines and my father is from a Mennonite community in Indiana. I grew up in quite eccentric parts of the United States, including southern Utah, where polygamy is still quite common, southern Nevada, as well as Hawaii. And so even while growing up, I think I saw that different ideas about family life were, you know, clashing, but also being negotiated on a daily basis. And as I, you know, grew to become an intellectual historian of Scotland and of the 18th century more broadly, I think it's that background that perhaps, informs my interest in aspects of gender in the family.
That's a very kind of interesting link that I'm sure we can come back to. So what were your motivations then, specifically writing about John Miller and the Scottish Enlightenment on this topic?
Right. So I wanted to tell a story about how cultural difference was negotiated in the Enlightenment, and namely that relating to the domestic sphere. So questions of marriage, family life, child rearing, et cetera, and how these were intellectually appraised. And I think I wanted to do this in a way that was somewhat different than older studies on individual figures in the Scottish Enlightenment, which tended to be framed along how these figures anticipated certain modern disciplines, so anthropology or sociology or even political science, for example. So my interest here wasn't so much to declare John Miller, who I ultimately decide upon as the most interesting Scottish Enlightenment thinker, to think through these issues about the encounter with family, familial difference. What I didn't want to do is declare him as the anticipator of anthropology or sociology. And indeed, that's perhaps the previous monograph, the only other monograph that has been written about John Miller in the past century. In fact, even included that in the title, that he was a forerunner of sociology. I would admit that, you know, by clearly establishing a disciplinary legacy for individual Scottish Enlightenment thinkers like John Miller might help us, you know, put them on a map and, you know, have a easy buzzword for them. But really my interest really was not so much the Miller himself, but rather the intellectual context he operated within and what, let's say, his decisions and what his arguments reveal about that time period, about that moment in the encounter between, the encounter of European thinkers with global diversity. So in a nutshell, my motivation here in this book was really distinctly contextual, to see how norms of gender, norms of family life, and ideas of civilization were being discussed and configured at this time period, the Scottish Enlightenment, which, of course, I think many of your listeners will know, is often understood as an important intellectual turning point in, you know, history of progress, narratives of development, the ideological justifications for British and Western, more broadly, colonialism as it, you know, ramped up in the 19th century.
That contextualization is so so rich in the book, and it's something that's that was really, really enjoyable and incredibly enlightening. But just before we move on, I think it might be helpful to perhaps give listeners a brief overview of who John Miller was and perhaps the contribution that he's traditionally or has been seen to have kind of had for intellectual history.
Right. So let's just start with maybe a biography of John Miller. You know, let's hit at the basics. So he certainly was an important, if not the most important figure of the Scottish Enlightenment. And I'm not, as much as I have grown to care for John Miller as part of, you know, researching for this book, working on him, you know, reading his work quite closely for probably a 5-year period. As much as I care for him, I'll admit that he's not the most important figure. But what's really interesting and what allows us to contextualize him within the Scottish Enlightenment is his connections perhaps with more famous scholars, above all Adam Smith. So he was Adam Smith's star student. He studied closely under him at the University of Glasgow. And then after completing his studies, just a couple years, he went on to be appointed as professor of civil law there. And he held that post for nearly 40 years, from 1761 until 1800. Really, John Miller's, aside from his two main treatises, which were The Origin of the Distinction of Ranks, and then his later Historical View of the English Government, Miller really lived a faculty life, was really closely engaged with the university. He's quite famous for having revived the study of law at the University of Glasgow. You know, like student numbers shot up. Star faculty member. But besides his activities at the university, he also networked very closely with other leading figures of the Scottish Enlightenment in between his appointment as professor of civil law and his time studying at the university. He actually served as a tutor for the children of Lord Kames, who was a very important philosophical judge and very well, very generous patron of Scottish Enlightenment thinkers. He also, was in discussion, conducted correspondence with David Hume, other figures. Unfortunately, a lot of the correspondence we don't have. Miller really followed in the tracks of his great mentor Adam Smith, including in having most of his correspondence and unpublished material burnt, around the time of his death. So while that may have preserved, let's say, the average level quality of what remains, it of course is no fun for an intellectual historian, which indeed did pose some challenges when researching this book. Also with John Miller, I think another aspect which is quite curious in terms of, let's say, setting him against his counterparts is that he never left Britain. He only traveled outside Scotland for a couple of times, for a couple of journeys to England. And so in contrast, for example, to Adam Smith or David Hume, for example, his network in a way that extended outside of Britain was weaker and was only based on correspondence. Let's go on maybe to think about the legacy of perhaps his most important work, which was The Origin of the Distinction of Ranks. And that really constitutes the basis of my analysis in this text. This is the work in which Miller deploys a really rigorous analysis of the links between economic relations and social relations, and the way that this came to satisfy, let's say, the basis of my curiosity, which was, you know, questions of gender, questions of family, and questions of global diversity. He did this by renovating the Aristotelian paradigm of the distinction of household authority relations. And I think we'll talk about that a bit later. But it's that type of analysis, that use of the stadial paradigm, that really served as the basis of interest in Miller as Miller's works were rediscovered during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Miller's basically influence went pretty much forgotten during the 19th century. He became quite an obscure character. But what happened was in the early 20th century, Marxist scholars identified in him a pioneering spirit of economic determinism and historical materialism. So first instance, Vanna Sombart, but he was followed by important scholars such as Ronald Meek and later Hans Medick. We can also talk about this later, but the connection between Marx and Miller is quite interesting. The theory that Marxist historical materialism has its roots in Miller is actually based on the fact that Marx kept extensive notes of his reading of Miller's Origin of the Distinction of Ranks. But in fact, when we go into those notes, we'll see that what's here is really interesting is it informed not so much Marx's historical materialism, but rather Marx's history of the family and gender that, you know, was later, which was later, well, re-edited and published after his death by Engels. But so a lot of attention to Miller was based on, this notion of him as anticipating historical materialism. And then later this shifted, as I already mentioned, to an idea that Miller's, his attachment to system, his interest in system, and his also supposed use of empirical sources made him a disciplinary predecessor of sociology, and that was put forth by Lehmann. More recently, over the past few decades, attention to Miller has really focused around the same set of questions that, you know, have driven me to him as well, which are questions of gender, questions of history, questions of the encounter with global difference. And here I'm thinking of scholars such as Jane Rendell, Paul Bowles, and Sylvia Sebastiani. On a final note, there's been a, you know, interest here on Miller's politics. He frequently was considered the most radical member of the Scottish Enlightenment, particularly, given that he was a bit younger than, you know, the core scholars like Adam Smith, William Robertson. He actually lived into the period after the French after the outbreak of the French Revolution, which Miller initially supported. And so some scholars such as Duncan Forbes, and particularly Michael Ignatieff, have discussed that aspect of Miller. Forbes put forth the notion of Miller as a scientific Whig, which is an interesting approach for sure. And just to say, maybe to combine all these things, going on just from, you know, why was Miller found to be interesting by scholars subsequently to what I praise as his signature contribution to intellectual history, his contribution has to be placed in the context of the Age of Enlightenment, and indeed it is his spirit of synthesis and the way that this configured his attempt at stadial history. I think that's very established. But on a secondary note, I also think we find in Miller a really sensitive eye to history, and especially a type of social history. And that's particularly developed in historical view of English government. And end this point right here, as I know many readers of this book have found, as much as I, you know, appreciate his sensitive eye to history, I think we should also think about where that eye was directed in terms of his interest in history, which was fundamentally local. And so this led both implicitly as well as explicitly to a historical gaze connected with the history of progress that was fundamentally based on Europe and even more narrowly on the history of Britain.
Thanks, Nick. And I think that very complex character comes through so clearly in the book, and I think you present such a kind of fascinating tapestry of all these kind of elements of Miller's kind of thought and person. But just moving on, could we get you to kind of outline the structure of the book and kind of how the argument progresses?
Right. So what I've decided to do in this book is focus on a number of case studies. And again, this is because the question of this handling of evidence about, difference in, gender difference, familial difference in different societies, how that was engaged constitutes, let's say, the starting point of the analysis. Although the book is, has John Miller as the core of its title, my interest here is in using John Miller as a form of guide to the broader questions of the historical diversity of, and the global diversity of family practices and the Enlightenment and the way in which that difference functions as a sort of intellectual challenge during the Enlightenment. So again, just to recap that, like the way the book is structured is using what I call domestic differences or, certain issues relating to gendered and familial difference as the focal point, rather than organizing the text just on the basis of, let's say, Miller's analysis itself. I'm trying to unpack the analysis here and, and put a focus on how Miller, in a way, dealt with this empirical side of his thoughts on household authority aspects. So the each case study relates to the analytical paradigms of these questions that were that were debated broadly in the 18th century and indeed before then. These were sort of early modern concerns generally. In the three first chapters. So let me just go through the chapters right now. So the first is on polygamy. The second is the question of matriarchy, or to use the term more common in the 18th century, gynecocracy. Matriarchy didn't really become a popular concept until Bachofen's analysis of the 19th century, but we see the underpinnings of the notion of matriarchy as a sort of inversion of patriarchy already developed in the, by the 18th century before Miller, indeed. And then the third chapter focuses on a very specific iteration of matriarchy, namely its possibility and its place within a sort of historical schema of the social contract, which was the Amazon. This chapter is especially interesting in that the Amazon served as a sort of basis for thinkers in the Enlightenment to test both the interrelationship between a rereading of classical testimony with the reading of a more recent ethnographic material collected from the age of explorations in the 16th century onwards. And then moving on from the Amazons, under the fourth chapter, consider race and the way that race was configured or not in Scottish Enlightenment discussions of national character. And here Miller recedes a little bit to the back, to the sidelines. And then in the fifth chapter, I take up what Miller thought of his contemporary society, namely the gender and familial relations, the practice of marriage, the relationship between parents and children in his home, in his contemporary moment, and his ideas fears, his anxieties about the future of family life. So the argument of the book, just to go back to the point, is again to focus on Miller's contributions within the intellectual landscape of his place, of his time, to place Miller within that, but also to delimit Miller's contribution. And what I am trying to do here with this structure is a type of intellectual biography that, is rigorously contextual, but also avoids a type of hagiography, a type of intellectual hagiography. And I think that is really the methodological contribution that I aimed in this text. And, my point here is I don't want to make Miller out to be a greater work, a greater thinker than he necessarily was. I think he was a solid thinker and a fascinating thinker, but I really think what is interesting with Miller is the different ways in which he cobbled a distinctive argument in the intellectual debates and particularly world of sources that existed at his time. And I think if there's one thing that an analysis of Miller's choices and analysis evidence, keep coming back to as these chapters progress, it's the place of sources and the extent to which we have inductive rather than deductive use of sources happening in the Scottish Enlightenment. I think there's frequently this argument that certain unsavory conclusions offered in the Scottish Enlightenment. We can bring up, for example, David Hume's infamous, writings on race. Frequently, there's a thought that this was due to limited evidence available, or this was due to a sort of like circumscribed, global perspective. And really, I think this rests on somewhat on quite patronizing bases. Really, these type of conclusions were not based on, the sources themselves. These were based on, the sources were always used strategically as part of a debate on difference in society that existed in the Scottish Enlightenment and, ideas of the history of society. So really here, the the point of using the case study format is to make this argument again of the of really the deductive function of source use in this Gaussian enlightenment.
And I think we'll definitely come back to this topic of sources and evidence, because it's a really kind of driving force in the book. But I'm really struck by how you talk about John Miller as a guide and a kind of this methodological approach. I think that's a really nice way of kind of condensing what you've done in the book, that using John Miller as a guide to explore this much kind of wider and richer context. But let's dive then straight into chapter one. To kind of really get to the nitty gritty here. So here you explore Enlightenment ideas regarding polygamy. So could you describe a little bit about how polygamy was variously viewed by some of the thinkers that you include in the book, and maybe explain why it was such a very, very contentious topic at the time?
Sure. So polygamy really was the focal point of 18th century discussions on let's say, different forms of marriage, much more than actually the right to divorce, which I think is that's a really interesting aspect that we can unpack maybe later. But the reason why was often, let's say, in terms of like Enlightenment philosophers. So if we think of like Montesquieu, Miller included, if we think about what they found interesting about, or let's say very different in other societies, it was how marriage could be, structured differently. And there, in a way, there's no more basic structural difference than, you know, monogamy versus polygamy. So it functioned as a way of discussing marriage practices in almost every other society that Europe thought or considered civilized during this time period. So, of course, like the Ottoman Empire or Turkey, as it was more often referred to in 18th century sources, also China, Japan, for example. These thinkers reflecting upon marriage practices in other societies came to this conclusion that polygamy essentially dominated or was permitted in every society in the world besides Europe. And so when then thinking about how just in terms of sources, it was an inevitable thing that would come up was polygamy. And this presented an interesting challenge for Miller, and a lot of his arguments based around this, which is how could, why did Europe not have polygamy if this was generally a feature seen in most other wealthy, he wouldn't use the term as such, but, you know, civilized or developed societies. But of course, you know, as broad of a question as that ultimately became, more narrowly, it also had to do with Europe's specific history in relationship, especially to Ottoman expansion, and, you know, to go even farther back to, the general aspect of the Crusades, of, you know, notions of Christendom, in which polygamy was tied very specifically to Islam. I mean, that gave a certain color to the discussions of polygamy in the time period. But at the same time, the uncertain proscription of polygamy in the Christian tradition also was revived not just conceptually, but also as a practice during the Reformation. This actually gave cause to a really interesting event in 1780, which ends, you know, that decade in the 1780s, in which I discussed with some detail in the book. And this was the Madame controversy. And so this was when polygamy was put on the British public stage. A rather eccentric Methodist decided to advocate the legislation of polygamy as a means of protecting women. The byline of his text, which was called Thelathora, was a treatise on female ruin. This occasioned a huge public outrage among the public with, you know, all sorts of pamphlets, plays, texts written about it, almost all, you know, against polygamy. And here we saw a couple, you see not only the use of, in this cultural production, constantly rehearsed connection between polygamy and Islam. So, you know, Madan was imagined as a covert Muslim, for example. But you also saw in these debates, quite interestingly, the strategic deployment of Miller's ranks and his discussion of polygamy in them. And so that's all shown in the text. At the same time, you know, a lot of the sources that Miller used on polygamy and other scholars at the time also used derived not from, let's say, China or from Islamic countries, but they also came from the 16th century, where you have, you know, the famous case of Munster, the attempt, you know, the sort of like fleeting period there. We had community of property, and you had, you know, community of women. And so this, yeah, so, you know, here you see this, even though there's this conceptual connection with Islam, also with other societies more broadly, there also, it also functioned as a debate, perhaps, that wasn't as far-fetched as it might seem to us today, because of, you know, this period of the Reformation. And again, one other reason why polygamy was so featured so prominently in debates of this time period was that it provided an alternative analytical paradigm to discussing differences in marriage structure. Basically, monogamy, polygamy, or the possibility of divorce. That's frequently what was used, this trio. Miller chose, instead of that trio, which was used by a lot of other of his contemporaries, like David Hume, for example, chose to discuss, you know, family difference just through that paradigm, through marriage. Miller chose to focus on household authority relations more broadly. Both of these paradigms, the trio of lifelong marriage, polygamy, and divorce versus, and the authority, Aristotelian authority relations the relationship between husband and wife, father and son, master and servant, and sovereign subject. Both of those, you know, had their roots in natural law, and they had been discussed by a number of thinkers. But really what was interesting about Miller was to subject this Aristotelian paradigm to historical and, you know, ethnographic analysis. To answer, you know, the core question of how did Europe's contemporary family relations come to the fore? Now, here, what's interesting with polygamy is that, you know, Miller, I think, went this route because he didn't just want to talk about marriage practices. He wanted to talk about, you know, different dimensions of the family more broadly. And so what the Aristotelian paradigm offered him was a more encompassing approach to the history of the family, in part because, you know, his main interest was writing a history of authority, and the sort of a history of authority that would go from, you know, the beginning of authority, or the beginning, I'm sorry, of civil society onwards. And even though I start at polygamy, which again is sort of reflects the sort of alternate paradigm that Miller had at his time, the reason why I'm doing this again is to uncouple the logic of his analysis, which again, you know, the first chapter begins of there's four broad sections of the text, which correlate to these four Aristotelian power relations, the husband and wife, father and son, master and servant, and sovereign subject. Miller kind of changes the place of those, and sovereign subject's not so much Aristotelian as sort of like 17th century natural legal. But what I do is by putting polygamy as this, like as this first chapter, it, again, is to uncouple the sort of progressive analyst that Miller develops in this text, and to hone in exactly on the context and what choices Miller and what alternatives Miller had to structuring his analysis.
So in spite of this furore surrounding polygamy, there are some kind of more, I suppose we could call pragmatic kind of views on polygamy that you introduce, which are linked especially to debates on population. Could you tell us a little bit about why population growth was such a pressing issue and how this was factored into shifting ideas of the family?
Right. So I think it can be often forgotten, especially for those of us who are less engaged with social history, to remember just how slow population growth was generally before the industrial era, and especially how devastating the wars of the early modern period, as well as pandemics. I think we're more aware of the damage of pandemics now than perhaps a year ago. I think we're all a bit more alert about that. But how devastating pandemics and wars were demographically. So in Germany, for example, during the 30 Years' War, you had areas where the population declined by over 40%. In Britain, Britain generally saw, you know, healthier rates of population, so this was less acute. But in other European contexts, you know, the population and how to essentially grow population rates beyond what not to increase absolute population increase, but just to restore population was really an obsession in the Central European context. And just on a side note, you know, my interest here in the relationship between polygamy and enlightened era populationism is one of the aspects that that I take up in my chapter in a recent collected volume that I put together with Erin Ottola on Cameralism and the Enlightenment is the title, and that's from Routledge. So you, your listeners can check that out if you're interested in those questions. But anyway, what I was interested here in exploring these pragmatic interpretations of polygamy, which were not just, let's say, limited to Central Europe, but also featured to a certain extent in Scotland, was again trying to contextualize Miller. Miller was not really interested in the populative possibilities of polygamy, but David Hume was, for example. David Hume was basically negated the idea that polygamy led to a possible population increase. But again, this is exploring this allows us to contextualize Miller against this context. He's not interested in the question of population growth, which I think says something about where Miller is going in his analysis. And again, maybe just to return, to this topic, again, you know, I think it's important to see, and this is how Miller does relate a bit to polygamy, this experiment in Munster, the relationship of between the Reformation and polygamy. There's this really interesting thing where, like, let's say in Central Europe, you have certain exponents like Eusti who are promoting polygamy and then are vilified for it. And I think there's often this knee-jerk reaction that we have now to see, okay, well, polygamy was detested in 18th century Europe, beyond the pale because of its associations with Islam. But at the same time, we should also think about it as in its connections with a period of radical Protestantism, a period of, you know, radical Reformation that by the 18th century was being seen as a rather dark period in Europe's history.
I think that's a very good warning there for intellectual historians to pay more attention to social history. But so moving on to your second chapter, which is called Before Patriarchy, Maternal Power in Primitive Societies. Now here you explore Miller's discussion of an early society in which women prevailed over men, and it's absolutely fascinating. So could you explain what led Miller to make such a conclusion and perhaps describe some of the examples that he uses to support his argument?
Right. So in a nutshell, I mean, to give a very intellectual historical answer to this, I guess, after the social historical of the last one, I think what Miller is doing here is he's really drawing on Hobbes. And this is because Hobbes develops a really interesting argument, in terms of, you know, his development of a concept of social contract as a root of, the authority relationship or authority submission to political authority. Hobbes really emphasizes that there is this transitional moment in the early history of civil society from essentially maternal dominance or maternal authority to male authority. He sees Hobbes basically lays out this argument that in a world, in this sort of, this period of early society, the only society that exists is that between a mother and child. And because marriage doesn't exist yet, polities don't exist yet, one would assume that this alliance between, or the affections and the respect held by the child to the mother would persist. And this would give rise in certain instances to societies where, very early societies where women actually held political authority. And so Miller basically reiterates this argument. And what he does beyond Hobbes is to actually, draw on contemporary sources. And this is the second chapter of his, the first half of the book. And it's really the first half of the book, even though he talks about other authority relations, that between husband and wife is a serious focal point of his analysis. And what he was using Hobbes here for, and what he was still he was still taking Hobbes's answer quite seriously for addressing the question of this stage of this early history of civil society. And what this allowed him to do is actually engage testimony, which many other thinkers just left out, about various societies across the world in which sort of matriarchal, what we would now call matriarchal practices were evidenced. But, you know, in terms of Miller's historical time and his history of progress, he really was adamant that, you know, this was not so much, let's say, gynecocracy, which is a term that we see in Diderot, for example, but this was rather the maintenance of maternal power in primitive societies. He really was keen to circumscribe this exalted role of the mother to a very early stage in the history of polities. And so this had clear ramifications to his idea of this as, let's say, its place in his contemporary world, right? He backdated this in terms of historical time, in terms of the history of society. This use of Hobbes, I think, is really interesting in that the connection between Miller and Hobbes has not really been problematized or investigated before. And so I think this, what I do in this chapter does, present maybe one way of thinking about Hobbes's continued legacy, because this is really this answer he comes up to with is not found in, is not found in Locke, it's not found in the other Scotch 19th thinkers. So it's quite curious. What's important to underline here is that this had much less to do with a proto-feminist inclination. It had to do with his history of authority. Let's just talk about maybe some of the sources that he used. So a lot of these had been previously mentioned by Montesquieu, and this was sort of common in, this period of Enlightenment social reflection of the history of society. A lot of the testimony, well, Montesquieu just, came up with all the sources, and then, other scholars then reread them, in his history of the law. And what we see is that in a couple of the main examples that were provided were the people of the Malabar coast in India, for example, who were reputed to practice a form of polyandry. There was also the political practices of Native Americans in North America, such as the Iroquois. This has been rather well discussed. Also the people of the Mariana Islands. This is now the biggest island in this chain is Guam. This is a Spanish colony from the Age of Explorations. It was a stopping station between Manila and Acapulco in the, in the galleon trade. And there you had reports of a maternally focused property and household regime through a late 17th century writer named Charles Le Gobien. And then I go into depth about where Le Gobien's testimony came from, how Miller read Le Gobien, and how other scholars at the time also read Le Gobien. Finally, and this leads us to the next section, one of the sources that Miller used was the Amazon.
Then let's pick up on those Amazons, because I think that's one of the most striking, well, all the chapters are striking, but this is a particularly interesting one. So here's where you're uncovering Miller's views on what is a very, very popular theme in Enlightenment thought. So this is the social and gender dynamics of the Amazons. Could you just give listeners a very broad overview of the kinds of tropes that existed in European discourse regarding Amazons, and how and why they were being used so frequently by Enlightenment thinkers?
Right. So with the Amazons, it's quite interesting. Really, they featured frequently in especially in the Scottish Enlightenment, but in other contexts as a sort of like a negative role, negative character. Right. It was just like, okay, well, how are they impossible? That became frequently like a thing that you see rehearsed time and time again. It would be like, oh, this is these fantasies from the Renaissance or classical antiquity. This was source failure on the part of, these travelers that had gone to the Amazon River Basin, for example. I mean, the river basin named after the fact that the first European explorers there thought that they had seen Amazons. It kept on coming up and again, is like, how could people have been so mistaken? You see the sort of like, Enlightenment versions of arguments of, marvelous possession, for example. Miller didn't want to do that. Miller, in fact, would try to use this renovation of Hobbes's discussion of maternal authority and heightened place of maternal power as a way to have to say that, well, maybe what these 16th century explorers saw in the Amazon River basin and elsewhere, and this was not, let's say, this wasn't an observer error, but this perhaps is more of an analytical issue. What Miller wanted to do was he wasn't defending that the Amazons actually existed as, in the conventional, in the formulation of the conventional trope, right? Which was, single-breasted women, militant, there's a gender revolution, they lived apart from men, they raided, integrated societies frequently for their, for provisions. They would do this very strange practice where, once annually or once every few years, they would commune with some men to get pregnant. That all featured quite commonly, especially late 17th century, but also 18th century discussion of the Amazon. What Miller wanted to, Miller was essentially trying not to just, and this actually reflects a lot about how Miller uses his sources. He wasn't just content to say, okay, well, these are marvelous. They're impossible. They don't exist. This is ridiculous. This belongs in the realm of fantasy. What he actually tried to do was describe how a society that had where women had a more active role in politics and in property relation and power, how that could have existed in a different time period. Let me draw attention to, I think, one of the most interesting discussants of the Amazons, and this is who Miller footnotes on the topic, and this is Pierre Petit. So he's a really fascinating character. I think that there hasn't been a study done on him. I think that somebody who's really interested in, interested in working on, maybe the late legacies of humanism should take him up. So Petit was a late 17th century French lawyer. Who applied Cartesian dualism to not just the Amazons, but another marvelous report from classical antiquity to the cannibals. And what you see in him is a really interesting application of both humanist reading practices and the sort of Cartesian duality between mind-body, but he called it body-soul. This was more conventionally Catholic. But really what I think you see here is an interesting counterpart to people like Poulain de la Barre, who Siep Sturman, for example, has brought our attention to as a really early feminist thinker. So Millard drew upon Petit to source his brief discussion on the Amazons. And by forging this connection between Petit and Miller, my goal here again is to draw attention to this sort of wealth of sources, this wealth of possible paradigms that Miller had at his disposal to write his progressive history.
I just want to pick up on that point of sources and evidence. Could you tell listeners a little bit about the ways in which Miller's use of these kind of evidentiary sources was somewhat different to contemporaries, also kind of thinking about Amazons and kind of matriarchal societies?
Right. So one reason why, frequently the word scientific is used to describe Miller. So if you think of Duncan Form's Scientific Whig, for example, or, this idea of him as an early sociologist, is his use of the footnote. And he, compared to contemporary, 18th century standards, he certainly was a more enthusiastic user of the footnote than other scholars, let's say compared to Montesquieu, for example. And his practice of the footnote is quite, this actually was one thing I found very interesting when I first, started encountering Miller's works. And, he offers page numbers, he offers the book titles, he offers the author sometimes. So this actually makes it quite easy to replicate his citation practices or his reading practices through his citation practices. And so these drew me in. And in a way, that's really how I got to Miller's, to writing this book, is I was following the footnotes. He drew on a rather wide range of sources, some of which were from classical antiquity, most of which were travelogues, compiled since the Age of Exploration. And what we also see in the footnotes and types of works he was using is what languages he could speak, or read. So in addition to English, he read Latin and French. He did use sources collected in other languages, but these were mainly through translation. And one of the themes I also focus in on these first three chapters is, again, this aspect of, what happens to the testimony as it transitions between languages. Some of the sources he used were like fifth-hand sources. And again, I do this and I make this point about the sources again, to sort of focus to evidence how Miller read his sources strategically. Sometimes, you know, there would be a piece of information like two paragraphs later in the source that he had quoted that sort of disproved how he had just used it. And to me, it's unlikely that he didn't read that. I actually think that he read things quite closely, but rather he cited sources very strategically to emphasize, certain points that he wanted to make. And I think, one thing I really want to do in the book is I really want to argue that we should take the source use more seriously than is often done. We should view source use as a practice, you know, not just the practice of footnoting, but also this reading practice. We should focus on this, closely, rather than just accepting in quite a vague way that Miller is engaging in a type of empirical analysis.
Thank you. What a testament to the history of the footnote and its importance. So you turn then in chapter 4 to Enlightenment assessments of the domestic order of colonial Spanish America, and above all in relation to race and how knowledge of the diverse familial world of Spanish America came to the attention of figures of the Scottish Enlightenment. So could you explain the forms, coming back to that point that you've just made, so that the forms in which this information was reaching individuals like Miller, and why the racial hierarchies of the Spanish colonies were of particular interest to those who were engaged in studying the science of man?
Right. So I think that some readers find this chapter a bit puzzling and why I included it. Partly, I think it's important to think of, I think it really behooves the scholars of the late 18th century to explain what the thinkers they're now analyzing, what relationship they had to either sources about race or particularly analytical paradigms of race. I think this is a blind spot that can't be left. At the same time, Miller really did not use race as much as a central paradigm. And to me, that became something to explain. I appreciate that some intellectual historians think that there's no need to problematize what is in fact an absence, but I disagree with that. Really, what's interesting here, Miller receives to the backdrop except for a footnote. I mean, to bring that back up, and why I decided to write this chapter was Miller quoted quite extensively from sources that were sourced from Spanish America, and he even mentioned, for example, that one of the figures that he analyzed to represent cultural practices in more primitive society was a mestizo. And there, I think it's quite curious. Again, I think it would be very ungenerous to the thinkers of the time to just say, okay, Miller maybe knew nothing about Spanish America. I think that's very unlikely. In particular, because there was a waging debate between. Well, not only was William Robertson developing his history of America, for example, that focused mainly on Spanish America and the conquest of the Americas, the Christianization of the Americas, but also a debate that was happening between Lord Keynes and Lord Bobodo on aspects of race. And Sylvia Sebastiani and her work has done great stuff to recover that. But one thing I really wanted to understand was how we can situate Miller's work, which again made so much use of a discussion of differences between societies, how we can contextualize that upon late 18th century discussions on race, and how race featured as a distinguisher between different peoples and also their family practices or the gendered practices. In part, one reason why Miller did not draw upon the paradigm of racial difference was also his skepticism broadly to climatic explanations for differences in, for example, birth in birth ratios between boys and girls. This was something that Montesquieu used quite enthusiastically. And what Miller does in the introduction to his Ranks, for example, is to dispute that and say that, generally, he stakes a quite universalist claim about how the human body operates regardless of climate. This chapter is really about, is about focusing on the alternatives to Miller's type of analysis in its contemporary period.
And I think you make a really important contribution there to what is still a growing field, right? This the study of race and kind of ideas of race within the Enlightenment. And I think you make a very important kind of argument for it there. But I want to just focus on something that you bring up in this chapter, which is that this key contradiction between the global scope of Miller's account and his views on the universal human capacity for improvement. So could you unpick this tension a little bit, especially with reference to the Spanish-American case?
Right. So my interest in his strange use of Spanish-America is, you know, doubly as an intellectual historian, but also a global historian. And I was really fascinated by how he, like other Enlightenment thinkers, struggled to situate testimony from Spanish America in terms of historical time. In a nutshell, almost all of these thinkers knew that Spanish America had been radically transformed after the age of Iberian explorations. You know, that the conquests of Cortes and Pizarro were common knowledge. You know, there's no way they didn't know about this. But they continued to think of that evidence about pre-contact social life could still be extracted from Spanish-American locations, even when collected by Spanish priests discussing mixed-race individuals and Catholic converts. So to me, what I found really interesting here is how even despite that knowledge and such evidence of drastic cultural change affected by conquest, there was no impact upon the conventional understanding of historical character for Enlightenment thinkers. And I think what this reveals is the very limited degree to which these thinkers, and Miller included, really cared about the question of historical character beyond the application or the, you know, ramifications of it for the formation of their own, you know, their own specific historical character, what we would now call, you know, national identity. And so this blinder that exists kind of there is not something that I think, you know, it has received enough attention. And I think it, however, reveals a lot. It reveals it, especially in terms of how it related to historical time and notions of progress. It revealed the contradictory thinking that was endemic in the civilizing mission, not only as it was practiced in the 19th century, but also as how it was configured in missionary societies and Scottish missionary societies in the 18th century. And this was that Europe was normatively, you know, the best. Christianity had an important part of the story. Europe's social institutions were ahead of social time. You know, they were ahead in the story of historical time. And really what I was trying to do in this chapter is to outline these themes, you know, really probe a theme that, again, constituted a sort of absence in his analysis, and doing that, again, synchronously, not anachronistically.
In your final chapter, you then move on to talk about Miller's reforms for commercial society and how these link to his views on the family and also the individual, which I think is something really to kind of point out as this individual. Could you just give us a general overview of what Miller's vision of this society was and how it related to the wider intellectual and political climate of the Scottish Enlightenment?
Okay, so basically, one of the more interesting things that's happening in the, you know, as Miller's analysis develops and something that he subscribes to, like other Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, is commercial society and the place of the family in commercial society. And so what's interesting about commercial society for Miller is that it represents a sort of distinctive pattern from that in other world societies who had become quite wealthy and had also exhibited, you know, complex hierarchies. You know, stratified societies, you know, sustenance mainly, you know, sustained through agriculture, some forced labor, you know, great amounts of wealth that could sustain a sort of court society. What distinguished Europe from those societies was commercial society. And commercial society, what's really interesting how it functions for Miller is that this is basically his way of dealing with European particularity. So he has a history of monogamy that basically is, well, it is essentially based on the very specific history of Europe, which allows Europe essentially to break beyond the general rules that he outlines elsewhere in his work. So the general pattern of history is that actually society becomes more unequal and the relations between genders actually become less and less equal, and in fact more antagonistic, more based on the sort of master versus servant distinction. But what Europe had, because of the coincidence of the fall of the Roman Empire and the arrival of Christian moral standards and the disaggregation of property collections and the rise of feudalism. Again, this is a very historical argument that's not universalist, but particularistic. That enabled Europe to arrive to a period of luxury where power was divided quite evenly. Well, you know, power, there's a lot of division of power, and that even affected the household. For Miller, commercial society is ultimately based on, commercial society is specific to Europe, and it's based on gender relations, but also broader authority relations that are more individualistic and more, in a way, egalitarian than those found in other world contexts. So that's sort of like, again, Miller's history, Miller's analysis in the ranks is to sort of understand this in theory from a universal history of progress, but also because of, you know, again, his fidelity to sources, his fidelity to the local context, his historical eye, also to explain this in a distinctive history of Europe. So what did Miller think then of what this, what the implications of this sort of individualism, this commercial society, what did it mean for the future of family life? Well, he was really anxious. Like other Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, like Adam Ferguson, he really feared unintended consequences. And one fear he had was, even though he was, you know, it's a bit ethnocentric celebration going on here, but while he's very, happy, he thinks that, you know, relations between, fathers and children or husbands and wives is in a way gentler or more, level eye than in other societies, historical or contemporary. What he feared was that the spirit of individualism might actually have unintended consequences might actually set your family authorities to the point where poverty, for example, could increasingly become an issue for society. And this is his anxieties to commercial society aren't just specific to the family, but more broadly to this aspect of the relationship between the individual and other bonds with other people that conventionally would have been provided through, the family life or through the community. But again, this idea of the sort of like, isolated individual fighting for themselves in the world. So really what Miller is doing here in an interesting way, he's coming upon a concept, even though he doesn't quote it, of the modern family and the specificity of, and the issues relating to the, individualism, the spirit, and the contradictions and the tensions between sort of individualist spirit and, a type of domestic society based on reciprocal obligations.
So before we finish, Nick, I think we've gone quite thoroughly through the book at this point, but I just want to come back to this concept of history, and because really central to your book is this exploration of how figures like Miller are interpreting history and progress and historical time. So could you explain to listeners who are perhaps not as familiar with kind of the stadial histories of the Scottish Enlightenment, why this is really such an important juncture in the history of European thought?
Right. Stadial histories are crucial in that what we find in them is a kernel of a sort of distinctions that undergirded 19th century disciplinization, and namely between, let's say, anthropology and history. Okay. So what these stadial histories do in that, you know, they progress essentially, that usually there are four stages, sometimes three, but in Miller's case and other Scott's case, there were four. It's this transition from the stage of savagery to a state of barbarism or hunter-gathering. Then you have the stage of agriculture. And then finally you have a sort of civilized stage or commercial society. Okay. And really, like, the exact taxonomies differ, but what's important here is that there's this articulation of a different periods of historical time, which different societies in the world can occupy at different periods. I think perhaps the most important implication of this, besides, you know, its obvious effects on justifying, you know, colonial power or the civilizing mission, was again in terms of disciplinization, because it foregrounded this distinction between history, which was specific to civilized societies, particularly those with writing, and uncivilized societies who were viewed as, they lacked written testimony and thus falling into the remnants of what becomes anthropology.
Thanks, Nick. I might just quickly sneak another question in, but just your book, you know, is assessing and reassessing Miller's significance in the Enlightenment and the legacy of, you know, you've talked about legacy of Hobbes and stuff feeding into that thought. But what do you think that we should, as readers, perhaps take away or perhaps not take away from Miller's thought in 2020?
Right. I think that stadial history is, even if you haven't thought about it before, it's probably self-evidently complicated and connects with the issues if it connects to a lot of debates that's been having, you know, in the academy for decades now. But what I think what Miller offers us, on a positive light, and perhaps more than perhaps any other social enlightenment thinker, is the longevity of questions of change and diversity in family practice. And what's interesting that even in contexts often thought as pious as early modern Scotland, we see how gender and family were not merely tack-on issues, but actually focused in, actually existed as the heart of how contemporaries thought about society and thought about other societies.
We have a great deal to learn from that still. Before we let you go, Nick, can we get a brief idea as to what you're currently working on?
Okay, well, I'm currently working on, I've taken a bit of a global history turn, and I've become really interested in immigration. So this sort of continues the sort of population concerns. One thing that will be coming up soon is a trio of works that I've been working on about two indigenous monarchs in the Pacific. So in the 19th century, this is Abu Bakar of Johor and King Kalakaua of Hawaii, and the relationship between immigrant newcomers, budding plantation complexes, and et cetera. And of course, with colonial mission schools, and this is the sort of connection there. Both were educated at Protestant missionary schools, and both bought into locally specific notions of enlightenment. So this sort of was, this is partly born from a general interest I have in the global working out of the Enlightenment, which I know is a very contentious topic, but something I wanted to dig into. And then finally, another, let's say, longer term project I'm working on actually has to do with the global history of indigo. And I think this will interest listeners who are, you know, especially concerned with 18th century Scotland. One of the focal points here is Andrew Turnbull, who was a Scottish medic turned Mediterranean consul in the Ottoman Empire turned attempted indigo planter in colonial Florida. And so I'll be working on that in the next, over the next few years. So stay tuned.
Well, they sound absolutely fascinating. And I'm sure we will have you back on the show to talk about them. Nick, thank you so very much for being here again. And to listeners, just to repeat, the book is John Miller and the Scottish Enlightenment, Family Life and World History. Thank you so much, Nick.
Okay, thanks so much, Alessandra.
Bye-bye.